Hello and welcome to the Poorly Informed Podcast. Today's episode is a bit different, as I'm sure you can probably tell. It's just me, so we are doing an episode of Slightly More Informed, which is a series where we look at topics in slightly more detail than we would in the regular show. So today's episode is all about Russia, why it is, how it is, and the history behind that. So I hope you enjoy. Russia always seems to be in the news for something. Whether it's interfering in the elections in the United States in 2016, or in our own Brexit referendum here in the UK, there's always something that means they hit the front pages and they are always involved somehow. And it's not entirely surprising. If we look back at the past and see the USSR being this great power to rival the US for about 40 or 50 years, it's unsurprising that, much like China today, they were in the news a lot and they were really, really important to world politics. Now, they aren't quite as important. Things have taken a little step down. However, that presence in the global media has stayed. There is still this interest, this fascination with the Russian state. And for good reason, they seem to have a lot of impact on many domestic events across the West, usually for the worst. So it's not surprising that we find ourselves particularly interested in this one nation. Now, to understand why this particular nation is how it is and why they take such a keen interest in foreign affairs and interfere so readily, we really need to look back in the past, because Russia is quite an interesting country in that regard. They've got a unique set of circumstances that almost forces them to be how they are. While I would disagree, they have to be a nation that murders journalists, there are actions that, while you cannot condone them, they look logical if you're looking from the point of view of an authoritarian government in power in Russia. Now, to go through all of this, I'm going to first take a step back and look at the geography of Russia. I think that's one of the most important things in this study of this country, because fundamentally, that's the land that this country is on, is part of it, and defines it almost more than anything else. The geography of Russia has played such a key part in the moulding the Russian state as we know it. One of the main things in this is the North European Plain. Now, this is an area of essentially flat land, in broad terms, that runs across Northern Europe, sort of from Northern France, through Germany, through Poland, and then out into Russia. However, the major feature of this, at least for the Russians, is that there is a bottleneck. There is an area only about 300 miles wide, running through northern Poland and Germany, where the Carpathian Mountains in the south push this plain into this narrow stretch where it would be exceedingly easy to stop an army, or at least easier to stop an army here, than it would be, say, in central Russia, where a potential front could be 2,000 miles across instead of just 300. Now, it's difficult to understate the importance of this, because while we must think in modern warfare, armies can take up front lines that can be many hundreds of miles long. The Second World War was a series of front lines moving. But warfare wasn't always like this, and if we look back, it would be individual armies moving around. And that's why Russia had this need, almost, to control this area, because 300 miles is an area that can be patrolled by a single army. 2,000 miles is certainly not. So by guarding the small bottleneck in the North European plain, they essentially control the gates to Moscow. And that's what's so important about this area. If a potential attacker breaches this, they are suddenly onto this massive land expanse that is Russia. And it is also the most industrialized part of Russia, the richest part of Russia. When the Nazi invasion in the 1940s blitzed through Western Russia, the only reason the Russian state didn't fall is because it shifted so much of its industrial capacity eastwards and then wiped out in a series of burning farms, burning houses, essentially making it impossible for the land to be occupied by anyone, Germans or their own citizens, to the west. And this meant that the German army starved because their supply lines were too long, while the Russians succeeded. But it meant they had to dismantle essentially their entire industrial economy. And in the modern day and age now, that's really unfeasible. These factories take too long to build. You cannot win a war if someone captures your industry immediately. It cannot be rebuilt fast enough. People cannot be moved fast enough. Those lost cannot be retrained fast enough. And I think it's one of the main policy goals of Russia throughout all time to push their borders as far away from their core states of Moscow, St. Petersburg, these very, very rich Western cities. If they can push the borders as far away as possible from those, they are so much safer, because an attacking army would have to have supply lines so long in order to occupy any of these places that it's essentially unfeasible. They're too long. Not many states can have supply lines that long and still fight a war successfully. It really limits who can attack you. Only the world powers can do it. Or at least until nuclear weapons, and then that's an entirely different ballgame. But in terms of conventional attack, it's very difficult to see a European power being a threat to Russia if Russia can control the Northern Plain, either through influence by influencing Poland into being favourable to them in decisions, or through controlling it militarily like they did under the USSR. And that is one of the key sort of foundations of Russian foreign policy, and the history that we are about to go into will tie very closely to that, and I'm sure you'll be able to see the links between those two things. Now, the other major part of Russian foreign policy was ports. And this is simply because most of the Russian ports, those on the Baltic coast, those in the north, and those in the Far East, are all, for some portion of the year, locked in by ice. Now, that makes it incredibly difficult, because if for, say, 4 to 6 months of the year, you cannot trade through your major ports, you could be cutting in half the amount of money you could be making from there, which is disastrous for an economy. And that is something that they really, really cannot afford. If they don't have a major warm water port, it limits the ability of Russia to be a world naval power. They never were, they never will be, because they don't have those ports in sufficient numbers. But just one or two of these ports gives them some access to the world's oceans and the ability to project power. One of the reasons the US has been so dominant in the last 50 years is because of their carrier fleet. They have the largest navy in the world. I think it might be bigger than all other navies combined. I'm not entirely sure on that, so don't quote me. But it's, put it this way, no other navy could stand up to the Americans. No European navy, all the European navies combined, could not stand up to the Americans. The Russians could not stand up to the Americans. The Chinese could not stand up to the Americans. And the fundamental reason for this is that they embrace this idea of projecting power very early on. They built aircraft carriers, which are a floating airbase that means they no longer need. They don't need to occupy this part of this country and say, okay, we know this is your country, but we want an airbase here. Can we have it if we give you X amount of money? Or something like that, as other nations have done. Rather, they can sail the airbase towards any country within a matter of days anywhere in the world. And that gives them the ability to respond to conflicts so far away from home on such short notice that no other power is able to match it. It is simply impossible for a non-carrier power to match this. And Russia is not a carrier power. They have a single aircraft carrier that's substantially smaller, wasn't really designed to be a proper aircraft carrier in the first place, and is about 40 years old. So that really shows how hamstrung Russia is by this lack of ports. And if they were to lose the few remaining major warm sea ports they do have, it would be disastrous. It would essentially eliminate their ability to project power beyond their own borders, which, as a core part of their geopolitical goals, they must be able to do this. It is fairly central to their politics. So that's why a port would be so important. Now, to tie this back to the history, we're going to take a little step back and look a few years in the past. This is a brief history, shall we say, of Russia, and it starts with the fall of the Soviet Union. I'm not going to go before then, because the Soviet Union is an immensely complicated organization on many, many different levels. So we'll start with the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991. Now, to put it simply, this was a massive disaster for the Russians in particular. The Soviet Union disintegrated, they became the Federation of Russia, and they started reforming the economy from a state capitalist, centrally controlled, the state owns all the big firms kind of society, into a market economy where private individuals can own all these firms and they compete in a free market. And this was done through a process called shock therapy, architected by some top US economists and some economists from the IMF. To say this caused chaos would be an understatement. It's difficult to quite put this into perspective, but during these changes, the Russian economy was almost decimated. GDP fell by 40% up to 1999. Life expectancy fell. The quality of healthcare fell. The amount of people in poverty rose dramatically. Crime increased. Hyperinflation wiped out savings. For any of you familiar with Germany in the 1920s, similar situation. This was not a good time to be a Russian citizen. Also, as another effect of this, because they were privatizing essentially the entire economy, because very little was privately owned already, a very, very small number of people managed to buy a large portion of the economy for very low prices. Now, this led to them getting immensely rich, because if you buy an oil firm off the government, you now own an oil firm, and you probably didn't pay very much for this, considering they're trying to sell these off as quickly as possible. That can make you an awful lot of money very, very quickly. And it did. So some individuals got immensely rich off this. A very, very small number of individuals benefited greatly from the fall of the Soviet Union in that way. The vast majority of the people, their life expectancy collapsed. They were much worse off. And the other problem with this was those who did get rich generally thought, well, why am I staying in Russia? If Russia's so poor now, what can it offer me? So they and their money often disappeared abroad. So these Russian companies would be generating immense amounts of money because they have a massive oil industry there, for instance, massive natural gas industry. But the profits of this weren't going back into the Russian state. They were disappearing into offshore accounts to billionaires living all over the place. So it really crippled their ability for the state to make an awful lot of money and to be able to start stabilizing things. And on top of that, a lot of healthcare was sold off, for instance. They didn't have many ways to put money back into that without contracting private services, which in terms of healthcare, as I'm sure you know from the state of the US healthcare system, is more expensive and not necessarily better. Well, almost certainly not better. So that is the story of the 1990s. They weren't particularly nice for Russia. To cap it all off at the end, one of their provinces, I'm not sure if that's quite the right term, but thereabouts, Chechnya decided to rebel. Now, due to a near disaster of a decade, the standing prime minister, Yeltsin, was massively, massively unpopular. Nobody expected him to continue in office because he would never win. So it was quite a surprise then for the Russian people when his nominated successor seemed quite full of energy. He didn't seem to be tarred with the same brush that Yeltsin was. He was much more popular. He was seen to be a much more capable man. This man was, as I'm sure you all know him today, Vladimir Putin. He was a KGB officer during the Soviet Union. He'd done various political things after that, been accused of corruption a couple of times, the usual for a Russian leader. Now, he was appointed, and one of the first things he decided to do was act in a very strong way against these Chechenian rebels and act decisively. So he supported the war in Chechnya, and that was something that made him quite popular. People can support a war. It is a uniting thing if you're going to war against a common enemy. It makes you forget your divisions at home. So for him, it worked quite well. Now, in the next 10 years, as we look forward into the 2000s, Russia really did seem to be on the up. Putin seemed to be doing all right. He made a deal with the oligarchs who had previously privatized everything and made a load of money off the common people. He made a bargain with them and he said, you can keep your money, you can keep your immense wealth, we will not touch it, we will not interfere if you put your support behind me publicly. And most did accept this. They stayed fabulously rich and all they had to do was follow the party line and say Putin was a good guy and support him financially if he needed it. It's a small price to pay for an immeasurable amount of wealth for many of them. Not all did, of course, but they often ended up on corruption charges or various things, or maybe disappeared for some reason. It's a state that reminds you of a mafia kind of gang or a crime family, where if you keep the line, if you toe the line, things look quite good for you. You can make a lot of money. If you don't, people have a habit of disappearing or suicide by gunshot to the back of the head. It's that kind of system. But ignoring all that, back to the rosy 2000s for Russia. Now, in 2004, Putin was immensely popular. He got 71% of the vote. That is a very respectable amount in an election, provided it was a free election and no voter fraud was committed and there was no other interference, which, let's face it, knowing Russia is kind of what they do. So the chances of that being the actual results are quite low. However, I think at this point, at least, it's difficult to deny that there wasn't significant domestic support for Putin, even if they maybe were doctoring the election results a bit. Now, throughout the 2000s, things looked very, very good for Russia, and the economy grew for 8 years in a row between 2000 and 2008. GDP grew by 7% a year, and GDP measured in purchasing power grew by 72% in the same period, which is an immense amount. That is incredibly quick. That is, outside of China, almost unprecedented. China's always an exception to these things, but Russia is pretty exceptional as well. Now, if we fast forward a bit in time, the 2000s looked overall very good. People are richer, people are living longer again, life expectancy is climbing, mortality rates are falling, people in the cities have more disposable income. The people of Russia are genuinely better off than they were in 1999. But there is starting to be this sort of domestic opposition. Well, I wouldn't say starting to be, there always had been, but it got louder. Domestic opposition to Putin certainly sort of started hitting the world stage a bit more. We started seeing these protests. We started hearing from these journalists talking about their experiences, and people started noticing disappearances that maybe seemed suspicious. For instance, it was in 2011 when the first major protests against Putin occurred. They were protesting against election fraud, which in Russia, I'm sure you can understand, it's almost certainly been happening, and well, most certainly has been happening in Russia. So that was a major blow in many ways, because it really showed that there was this, maybe not united, but there was this very powerful and loud opposition to him. Even if they had no power politically, they had a voice on the world stage, because let's not forget, in all of this, the Russians had not turned to the US, so they were not friendly in any way with the US. In the 1990s, this could have gone either way. They could have, for the ultimate victory for the US, at least in their point of view, the Russians could have turned to the US and said, okay, we want a more productive relationship going forwards. We want to be closer to you economically. And this could have been a great benefit for both sides. I mean, I'd be surprised if US did not take advantage of this, as I think any country would, and probably garner some ill will from the ex-Soviet Union, from the Russian people. But it could have resulted in a Russia that was not isolationist and was not necessarily opposed to everything the West does. However, they did not take that route. They chose this more powerful in their own region route, where they were not going to be an economic superpower. The opposition with the US would see to that. And they could not compete with China either. They were very much stuck in terms of becoming an economic superpower. That was not going to happen. However, they could absolutely become a regional superpower. If you look at where Russia is, it's immense. They have loads and loads of resources and reasonably high manpower. They are entirely capable of they wish to be entirely capable of controlling all their borders and everything around them. Whether that actually happens remains to be seen, and it's something that's playing out now. But all of this means, to loop my tangent back into the main narrative, Americans are very much willing to make the Russians look bad or encourage anti-Russian sentiment and weaken the nation. They are still opponents. They are no friends of the Russians. So therefore, these anti-Putin protests get a lot of media coverage. They're something that the US is very pleased about, because they can show it on the TV screens all around the world, in the US and Western nations as well as less developed nations that might be deciding whether they enter into sort of closer ties with China and possibly Russia along with that, or side with the US and sort of this economic Cold War that's never really stopped, even after the end of the Soviet Union. So that makes the domestic opposition quite dangerous to Putin, because it's not so much that they have the appearance of some group that's going to take over the government and has a realistic chance of winning any elections. They don't. Voter fraud and election interference and all these things have seen to that. There is no chance of another party being voted into power. However, what there is a chance of is, because the Russians value stability so high, because if you think of all these major events that have happened in Russia, say over the last 120 years, we have the revolution in 1917. This is where we go from a monarchy that wouldn't have looked massively out of place in the 1600s into a civil war for a few years, and then into communism, which many people at the time thought this was the way of governing in the future. As we all know, it turned out not to be that at all, and the experiment that was the USSR was a disaster on a few levels, not to mention killing millions. However, the exit from that was just as traumatic. As I mentioned earlier, the transferring from a communist state, well, it's more of a state capitalist power, into a market economy was disastrous for the Russian people. They suffered greatly because of it. But these changes both happened very quickly. This was not like my own country, for instance, the UK. When we went from a absolute monarchy to the time we went into a sort of a full-on parliamentary democracy, this took centuries. This was a very gradual process that was years in the making and was violent at times, but they weren't sort of 180 degree changes made violently. There were small incremental things over time, usually peacefully, occasionally violently. But that's how we got how we are today. And maybe it's why the democracy and the rule of law is respected so much, because it's entrenched in our sort of national psyche, because it was built up after sort of through such a long time period. However, if you look at Russia, they don't have the luxury of this long and gradual change. It only took, it was an overnight change between the communism and free market economy. It was a couple of years of civil war between a monarchy and communism. They're very violent. These are very unstable times where the people suffer greatly as the regime changes. And it really sort of is not a good thing to be living through one of those times, because they happen so quickly and so violently often. They are not stable, and that is fundamentally what Putin sort of puts himself across as. He is a very, very stable government. He might be authoritarian, he might be favouring the rich, he might not be helping you, and he might murder a few journalists. However, he is stable. With Putin in control, there is relatively little risk of another one of these massive fundamental changes to Russian society that seem to happen fairly often, at least in the last century or so. So I think that's an important reason into understanding why people do vote for him and do support him. He's not necessarily who they like, but stability is often considered to be beneficial. Well, is almost always considered to be beneficial, but even at the expense of freedoms and rights, people sometimes just choose stability, and that is an important reason behind his strength. Now, that is why the protests are such a threat, because if he isn't looked to be stable, if there's looking to be this large opposition against him and the country is not united behind him, that creates the risk of him not being seen as a decisive and a leader who can control a country, and that is very, very dangerous for him. He is surrounded by very, very powerful, very, very rich individuals who could, if they so wished, pose a credible threat to his power, and if it was seen that he wasn't doing enough for the country, they could get the people's support. And in some sort of coup, violent or not, this could happen and he could lose everything. So for Putin, it is essential in many ways that he appears to be this strong man in control of everything, because the image is half of his power. And for the same reason, it's a fairly major issue for Russia if they get into big economic trouble. Big recessions and big problems with the economy are fairly large reasons to doubt the competence of your government. I know, at least in the Western world, a lot of the sort of nationalist and right-wing opponents to the current elites, as they are so-called, in power, arose after the 2008 financial crisis. These are people who feel like the government does not work for them. And as we have seen with the Brexit vote, which was quite heavily influenced by areas and thoughts of this, they can have quite a large impact on a country's voice and their country's opinion on their government. So for Putin, at least, he really can't afford to let this happen. It would be disastrous for him, because again, it would portray him as not being the most stable choice, perhaps not being the most powerful choice, and that gives his opponents ammunition, or even his so-called friends, these oligarchs, ammunition to use against him. But as I said earlier, a war, for instance, can be a great unifying factor, can be a great way of the leader looking like they are far more powerful and the country is far more united than it actually is, as we saw with Putin back in the late 1990s. So when Putin then goes and invades Ukraine in 2014, I don't think it should be quite as much of a surprise as maybe some people in the West thought it would be. They weren't expecting this, maybe. I think if you look at the foreign policy goals that I've laid out to you earlier, it seems like the Ukraine fulfills a number of these, which is why the Russian government has done it. They wouldn't be doing this if they didn't think it was beneficial to them. Now, so for a little background on Ukraine. Ukraine used to be a part of the USSR. They were sort of a state within the empire, almost, if you imagine it that way. They were a nation within this empire of the USSR. They essentially had no real power. They were probably the second most powerful nation, if you could call them that, within the USSR. But in the USSR, everyone took their orders from Moscow. They did have nuclear weapons, however, and interestingly, they are the only nation in the world to ever voluntarily give up nuclear weapons. When the USSR fell, they accepted a lot of aid from the United States on the condition they dismantle and destroy their nuclear weapons program. Now, Ukraine sits right next to Russia. They are right next to sort of the southwestern corner of Russia in Europe and have a very large land border with them. Now, this is very important because as I said earlier, one of Russia's big goals is to push the borders of their nation as far away as possible from the core territories of Moscow and Western Russia. Now, the border, after the Iron Curtain fell, and the Iron Curtain was sort of the westernmost expanse of communist influence, through Poland and Hungary. When that fell, suddenly there's these nations that used to be subservient to the Moscow and now have been let free. Whether they ally with Moscow or the US remains to be seen, and they could go either way. But if they go towards the EU and the US, suddenly the border between the Western NATO powers and Russia itself has moved much, much closer, and importantly, has moved past the gap in the North European plain between the Carpathian Mountains in the south and the Baltic Sea. It means that these nations now, if they turn to the NATO, present a rather major threat to Russia. They are vulnerable in this situation. They are very, very vulnerable to a NATO invasion. Now, it's somewhat due to this that the Ukraine was... they tried to keep the Ukraine under Russian influence, and Ukraine has so far sort of played this tightrope where they've been trying to play both sides, if you will. Can they get these benefits in exchange for looking this bit closer to the EU? But then if Russia gives them this benefit, they'll be able to go this much closer to Russia and almost get the highest price out of each of them, because neither the EU or Russia want Ukraine to be part of the other. It gives them a major economic disadvantage, and it is certainly a military consideration for NATO as well. This all came to a head in 2014, where the president of Ukraine looked to be pushing towards a closer agreement with the EU, but then the Russians stepped in and said, no, we can give you much more if you come with us. He pushed in favour of a pro-Russia solution, and this caused riots in the west of the country. Many, many people were not happy with these closer arrangements with Russia and what they felt was an undemocratic manner. This was not what the people wanted. The government fell, and there was disorder on a fairly major scale. And in response to this, the Russians to the east said, well, we need to protect Russian people. They have a law in their government where they are bound to protect Russian individuals and Russian, well, not Russian citizens, but ethnic Russians abroad. This is where they're not in their nation. They have no legal control of them, but they are bound to protect them by their own government, by their own laws. Now, this is important because it enables them to just kind of go to war with anyone on their borders because they might contain Russians. And they can choose if Ukraine contains a large number of ethnic Russians because they were, well, essentially one nation for the longest time. So there's people who have lived in both places, people who came from one and moved to the other, and so on and so forth. So they can, using this law, claim that they have a right to intervene and that they are justified in the fact that they need to protect their people, even if they are Ukrainians. Now, they use this as an excuse to, well, not an excuse so much as cover, for instance, for influencing, shall we say, in Ukraine. By influencing, what I really mean is an invasion without admitting they're invading anybody. In February 2014, Russian soldiers without insignias, so these are Russian soldiers without any identifiable Russian symbols or anything on their uniforms, on their tanks, on their equipment, they are entirely trying to conceal who they are. Everyone knows they're Russian, but they aren't officially, so no one can officially say that these are for certain Russians, because the Russian government can just deny it and say, well, no, our soldiers have insignias on their uniforms, so these can't be Russian soldiers. They are Russian, they just don't have insignias on their uniforms. These troops invade eastern Ukraine, and particularly Crimea. They occupy strategic objectives, so they seize major transport links, major junctions, major communication centres, and most importantly, if we tie it back to what I was saying earlier, the port of Sevastopol. Now, this is a port that Russia has been occupying. They have a naval base there. They lease it off Ukraine for, I'm sure, a large amount of money. But it looked, in the situation in Ukraine, as they might lose this port. And now, this port is not ideally situated. It's in the south of Crimea. It's hemmed in by the Bosporus, which means Turkey. If you look at a map and see, Turkey controls both sides of this very narrow strait into the Mediterranean. So, and Turkey is a NATO ally and part of NATO. So even if the Russians do hold this port, they are still hemmed in by a NATO force and have essentially in wartime no hope of getting a navy out of here, because the US, who, as I said, are the best in the world, by far the best in the world at projecting power, can sit a couple of carriers there, and from them, that moment onwards, no Russian ship is escaping unsunk through those waters. However, more importantly than during wartime, during peacetime, they are free to access these straits and leave into the Mediterranean, and then from there into the Atlantic, and from there into anywhere in the world. The other important thing, as I said earlier, this is a warm water port, and it is also a major port. By controlling this for 6 months of a year, this is essentially the only way they have of projecting power into the rest of the world. This is the only base from which they can do it for a large proportion of the year. So it is vital for the Russians to hold on to their one last base from which they can do this, because otherwise, are you really a world power if you cannot project your power for half a year? If a war starts in, I don't know, September, well, great, we can't get there between November and mid-March, so we either have the choice of sending our forces out and then having them stay out for most of a year, which is incredibly difficult to resupply, or we can't send them out until next year, by which time the situation may be disastrous and they may have lost a war or may have lost massive influence or major casualties, you don't know, all sorts of things. So it makes it, puts them in a very difficult position, because they cannot afford to lose this. At the same time, they are invading another sovereign nation, and while they are doing it under the cover of not invading a sovereign nation and merely supporting rebels in a sovereign nation, they are essentially invading Ukraine. Now, this made actually some people in the West quite glad that Ukraine hadn't joined NATO, for instance, because if Ukraine had joined NATO and they'd been attacked by Russia, every single nation in NATO is then duty-bound to come to the aid of Ukraine. This could cause World War III very easily, so many people are quite glad that they didn't join NATO and that Ukraine can just be sort of left to suffer on their own without causing a nuclear war. This is not great for the Ukrainians. They are suffering under the Russians, even though the Russians say they're not, and it's not Russians. Although actually, officially, the Russian state has annexed a part of Crimea. They carried out a referendum and said, do you want to be part of Russia? And unsurprisingly, 82% voted in favour of it. There was a number of people undecided, a number of people sort of in the middle, and a very small percentage said no. Now, I don't believe these figures. You probably don't believe these figures, and for very good reason. It's a Russian referendum controlled by the Russians. Of course they're going to vote in favour. Now, outside of Crimea, and in general Ukraine, 89% of Ukrainians don't want to be part of Russia, so I think it's pretty safe to say that those results were entirely made up, and that the referendum was entirely illegitimate and not valid at all. But that didn't stop the Russians. All they needed to do was make it look valid enough that no one would seriously question them, and their gamble paid off. They managed to invade Ukraine, seize a port, a major port, a very important port for them, and now they actually own the entire area, which is, if anything, more beneficial. They have massively hamstrung Ukraine's ability to fight back because they control the strait into the Sea of Azov, which some of Ukraine's major ports are, where the majority of their trade is done. So Ukraine now are kind of forced into Russia if they want to do anything, because Russia's holding a noose around their neck rather tight and can start pulling at any moment. This gives them immense influence, of course. And on top of that, the EU and the US didn't do all that much in opposition to it. There were sanctions imposed, and particularly by the US, the Russians did suffer. Their stock market suffered by 10% and the ruble collapsed. It's at an all-time low, or wasn't at an all-time low, against the euro and the dollar, which is not good economically for the Russians. But at the same time, they didn't get invaded or threatened to be invaded by NATO nations in Western Europe, which, while Russia absolutely is a threat to every nation in the world simply because it has nuclear weapons, they would still be flattened in a conventional war against the US and Western Europe. Well, simply because of the budgets involved, if you look at it that way. Europe as a whole has a vast military armament, even though many of the countries don't spend that much on defence. As a whole, it is still a strong, France and the UK in particular still have immense power in that respect. And then, of course, you have the United States, which is another ballgame entirely. They are in a different league. And the Russians could realistically not hope to defend themselves against a NATO attack. However, this will hopefully never happen, because, as I mentioned, the Russians do have nuclear weapons, and so do the States, and so do France, and so do the UK. So a general war between these countries could very easily turn into the end of the world for everyone. So I think it's probably a good thing that does not happen, hopefully ever. So this, in some ways, captures the Ukraine, as I said, and pulls them towards the Russians. And this is the same with they're trying to do with places like Poland, Romania, Hungary, which have all elected fairly right-wing nationalist leaders who are willing to have closer ties with the Russians, which is certainly a win for Russian foreign policy that has achieved pushing the borders back. As it seems, there are now not hostile nations right at their borders. They have a little buffer zone in Ukraine, and Ukraine aren't going to pose a threat, and they are moving into Eastern Europe and influencing those countries, if at least to be neutral, if not pro-Russian. As long as they are not anti-Russian, the Russians can be happy with that. And then this brings us around to the more famous events, at least for me, the events that really sort of I hear about a lot and I see a lot. And these are the 2016 election in the US and the 2016 Brexit referendum. Now, both of these were impacted by the Russians, particularly in the American election, because everyone knows it's happening. There was this big investigation, well, there still is this big investigation where Mueller is investigating Trump over his links to the Russians. And so far, a number of major indictments and arrests have been made. And potentially, we don't know, but it is not out of the realms of possibility that the president could be impeached over his ties with Russia. He is found to be acting against the nation's interests or something along those lines. And that is amazing to think a head of state be found acting in the interests of a foreign power. When you try people for treason, they're acting against their nation. It's a capital, well, if for many years it was a capital crime alongside murder. It's one of those things to betray your country was frowned upon by everyone. Imagine a head of state doing that. That really is something else. That unprecedented in recent times. But anyway, back to what happened. One of the other major things alongside with possibly collaborating with the Trump administration and Trump campaign was troll farms. Now, these are essentially large numbers of people on computers, either directly posting things on social media under fake accounts with fake names or whatever, or running botnets that do the same. And all these do, and all these seek to do, is push the conversation towards topics which benefit the Russians, for instance. So, for example, Russia wanted Trump to be in power. Trump is not a uniting candidate. He is someone that would cause big divisions in the US society. He arguably is, some would say, beholden to the Russians and seems to be far more friendly to them than maybe he should be. Well, I think he should be. So that creates a risk of influence. And if he gets into power, the Russians do benefit. He is less likely to be attempting to look strong against the Russians. He's more directing his rhetoric against China and immigration rather than Russians, which he has said he will be friendlier with Putin. And he is seeming to be friendlier with Putin, more so than Hillary Clinton would be, for example. And so these accounts all spammed Reddit, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all these places with information designed to discredit opponents to Trump and promote him as a candidate. And this is an incredibly cheap way of influencing an election. You only need a few hundred people paid what you'd pay a call center employee. It doesn't have to be much. Day after day, just doing the same thing. And maybe then you hire a couple of software developers to make you a botnet that then goes and spams these comments all over the place. It's not technically difficult for a nation state to do, and it's very, very cheap. This is pocket change for a state. But it can have a massive influence on an election. You can change a lot of people's mind by doing this, and maybe it did. Another thing aside from this was the hackers accessing the DNC, that's the Democratic National Committee, emails. They accessed thousands of emails from Hillary Clinton and various other people that revealed a bias against Bernie Sanders, who was another Democratic candidate attempting to run for the nomination. Now, this really hamstrung the Clinton campaign because she was seen as this establishment woman, this individual who was not looking out for the people. She was just one of the political elites. It discredited her not only to the right wing, who already hated her because they liked Trump, but also to much of the left, which felt disenfranchised with politics for the same reasons the right did. They did not feel they were getting the representation, but instead of turning to Trump, they turned to someone like Sanders. But they were shown that they were being seemingly discriminated against and pushed back by the people who are supposed to be impartial in this. That really did not help her campaign. She lost, and Trump came into power, which is very beneficial for Putin. And it's a very cheap way of doing it. As I said, it's not like you don't have to go to war over this. You're not spending trillions of dollars on economic aid to anywhere to influence their elections. It's a very, very small amount of money for a very large impact in global policy. And it's incredibly effective. In the same way as Brexit. One of the fundamental goals of the Russian state, as I said, is to push their borders as far away as possible from the core homelands. Now, if you do this by against a united Europe, which is very strong, it's very difficult to do because you have to push against all of Europe at once. That's very, very difficult. If they're united, they compose a big threat, both economically and militarily. However, a disunited Europe with maybe parts breaking off in the case of the UK and divisions being sown within there and just causing general chaos, it's a lot easier to say, well, Poland, do you want to come and sign this deal here? We'll give you more natural gas and for a cheaper price, let maybe a few soldiers onto our territory. Can we build a military base here? In that situation, the EU as a whole could deny that and offer Poland some maybe alternatives, and maybe Poland would rather just say close allies with the rest of the EU. But when it's so divisive and so split up, a country like Poland or any other Eastern European nation can sort of break away a little bit and isn't held so tightly in this European sphere of cooperation. They can do their own thing, and it is infinitely easier for Russia to influence them in that situation. So I would argue that Brexit is a disaster for the European Union and a massive pro for the Russians. They gain infinitely more power in Europe, and it furthers their goals immensely. And once again, it was a very cheap way of doing it. They provided a few donations. Well, they allegedly provided a few donations. We don't actually know who did, but to assume it's the Russians is not a greatly difficult thing to do. It does make sense. Of maybe tens of millions, in the region of $70 million, which is nothing for a nation state or individuals connected to that, to various Vote Leave people who then donated amounts of money to the Vote Leave campaign, which allowed it to campaign so successfully for us leaving the EU. So once again, Russian state achieves a major geopolitical goal, and it costs them almost nothing to do it. Now, if we have a look at the whole situation now, we are currently in the middle of Brexit. We have no idea what's going to happen with that. I mean, I can't tell you, and I don't think our politicians can either. We'll find out in a few months, or maybe a few years, who knows. But the current state of the world is that Russia is sort of shown to be on the up here. They have won a few major geopolitical battles, and their influence over the world is growing, I would say. The 2010s have been rocky, but not bad for them, and they are looking on the up. And at the same time, this is almost a zero-sum game, especially when it comes to Europe and NATO. They're looking weaker. The EU is looking weaker, NATO is looking weaker, and it gives a chance for this East to rise as a more powerful threat, which alongside the increased power of China creates a very interesting situation where the West is really clinging on to the dominance that it's had over the world for hundreds of years, well, half a millennia pretty much. But there are legitimately threatening countries from particularly Southeast Asia that are rising up to fight this, and Russia can take advantage of this. They are already forming alliances with China, while they may not particularly like each other because they have a big border or contending over influence over countries around there. They are perfectly willing, now that they are not the two communist powers in the world and aren't trying to be the leading communists, each of them trying to be sort of the one leading communism in the direction that it wants to go. Rather, they are now two powerful nations, both largely set against the West, one militarily very powerful and the other one economically very powerful and starting to become a military superpower. This involves, for instance, their alliance. They have just signed a 40 billion 30-year deal for 38 billion cubic meters of gas going from Russia to China. So they're on friendly terms, and they have been conducting military live fire exercises in the Mediterranean, which, while is one of the seas that the Russians can access from their port in Crimea, is very far away for China. And it's showing how now China is beginning to take part in this game of projecting their power around the world. And a China projecting their power into Europe is a legitimately scary thing for the European states. So to conclude all of this, when we look at the world now, the West is somewhat weaker. They're still, I would say, the dominant economic and military powers, but not by much anymore. And with China ever on the rise, and the same with Russia, how long it will last, we have no idea. I think it's somewhat unfortunate that the countries sort of opposing the West have to be like they are. We could have, I don't know, another bastion of global democracy in Asia or in Russia, but those are obviously not the case. And instead, we have a nation that kills journalists and is perfectly willing to engage in corruption and underhand dealings and all sorts of things. Well, like most nations are, but certainly to a bigger extent than most will. And it's disappointing, I think, that the powers sort of opposing the US, which I think you could argue has not necessarily been the best thing for world peace, instead of being country is genuinely opposed to the undemocratic and things that the US has done that could be seen as interfering in other nations unfairly and all that. The countries opposed to that are not nations pursuing democracy and pursuing human rights for everyone. They are nations that actively despise human rights and see it as a hindrance to what they do. And as I said, regularly murder journalists. For instance, there was a journalist called, and I'm going to butcher the name, I do apologise, Anna Politkovskaya. She was a fairly prominent journalist, actually. She reported on the wars in Chechnya. They always seem to come back to that. That's the Russian state. It seems to revolve around those for the 2000s, at least. And she was a very good journalist. There were some hostage situations, and she was part of the team that not only covered them, but also helped negotiate a way for women and children who were also trapped in there alongside men and rebel forces to escape those and save lives where the Russian government did not. So she's doing a good service to the country, at least. Well, to the people, at least. But that didn't endear her to Putin. She didn't toe the party line. She was poisoned once on the way to go to one of these hostage situations. And she was generally disliked by the establishment in power in Russia. And on the 7th of October 2006, this all sort of came to a head. She was found in the lift of her Moscow apartment, dead. She was shot twice in the chest, once in the shoulder, and once in the head. All of these shots had come from point-blank range. It showed all the signs to be a contract killing. A number of people were arrested for it. Whether they were the ones who carried it out, don't know. Who ordered it, we also don't know. It could well be a Chechenian leader. As always, it seems to revolve around Chechnya. Or it could be Putin, or it could be one of the many people that I'm sure she annoyed by being a journalist, which is a generally quite dangerous thing to do in Russia. In 2005, she wrote a book, and there was a quote from this book that I thought is quite fitting for this episode, as we have explored a lot about why Russia acts like it does, and why, for Russia, it is logical to act like it does. It invades the Ukraine, and influences Eastern Europe, and influences elections for reasons that another nation would see to be logical, that if we were in their situation, if we were an authoritarian power in Russia, we would do, because they make sense. However, that is not to justify it any way. It is horrendous what they do. And I think this quote in particular spells it out and spells out the terrible situation under which many Russians are living in and the way they are sort of trapped against this authoritarian government that can't afford to lose. And this is the quote. "We are hurtling back into a Soviet abyss, into an information vacuum that spells death from our own ignorance. All we have left is the internet, where information is still freely available. For the rest, if you want to go on working as a journalist, it's total servility to Putin. Otherwise, it can be death, the bullet, poison, or trial. Whatever our secret services, Putin's guard dogs, see fit." And that really sums up the situation in Russia. They may be doing what is logically in favour of them, but it doesn't make them good. So I hope you enjoyed that episode of Poorly Informed. This was a fun one for me, actually. There was a lot of research went into this, and it's quite an interesting thing for me, because the Russian state has always interested me in its many forms. So I hope you enjoyed, and I hope I didn't bore you with my endless tangents, as it seems to keep going on with. And I hope you learned something about Russia that you didn't before. So feel free to check out any of our other podcasts. Theo did another slightly more informed episode on Brexit, which would be very interesting to listen to. It covers the domestic political side of this, which, you know, could always be influenced by the Russians. Tie those two in together. As well as our regular episodes that will be coming out every week as per usual. So without further ado, I've just looked at the time and I've been recording for over an hour, so it's probably time for me to go. I'll see you all whenever. I'll be coming out with another one of these at some point, so I'll see you then. Goodbye.